This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Retail sales are down nationwide. Ground Zero, the shopping mall. After a series of closures at Eastland Mall in Bloomington, the owner of the Mole Hole, Ron Porth, says there's a lot of uncertainty about the place.
You know, the consensus has been that Eastland's a goner in a lot of people's minds. And I've told them that they have too big of an investment made.
Hear Ryan Denham's report on mall redevelopment. And GLT's culture maven Sherry Zeck muses about the mall's cultural significance. When your dog communicates, it can be loud, interpreted as aggressive, and bothersome to other people. Learn more about barking dogs during an edition of Animal House. And get caught up with the Robert Brown Band. John Norton talks with Brown about the new album, Phantom Power. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's August 1st, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Recent store closures at Eastland Mall are leading to speculation about its future. Can an old-school regional mall like Eastland survive? The answer is no, it can't, and that's straight from the mall's owner, CBL & Associates Properties. But they say a new version of Eastland could rise in its place. GLT's Ryan Denham has more about the future of Eastland Mall.
The wafting smell of a Cinnabon. The madness of Black Friday shopping. Getting dropped off by your parents so you can meet your friends at the arcade. For many of us, malls aren't just a collection of stores, they're a collection of memories. So it makes it so hard when our local mall is struggling. It hits harder than when a Circuit City goes under. Bloomington's Eastland Mall is struggling, no doubt. Macy's closed earlier this year, and JCPenney is next, October 1st. MC Sports is gone, and so is the Gap. Vacancies abound, and the food court is down to three eateries. Ron Porth has owned the Mole Hole at Eastland Mall for 21 years. He likes the mall, especially the foot traffic around the holidays, but says it's been nothing but bad news recently.
You know, the consensus has been that Eastland's a goner in a lot of people's minds in Bloomington, and I've told them that they have too big of an investment made to let it, you know, it's not going to die, but it can limp for a while till they get things straightened out again.
Mall owners, CBL & Associates, say that a turning point is finally here. A major redevelopment is planned at Eastland in the next few years, with big changes coming. CBL's spokeswoman says they can't release specifics yet until leases are finalized, but Stacy Keating says we can look at CBL's other markets for an idea of what could happen here.
We own a property, Cool Springs Galleria, just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, in Franklin, and we purchased the Sears building there in 2013, and we redeveloped that into an H&M, an American Girl, an Ulta Beauty. We also extended out into the former Sears parking lot and added a restaurant and entertainment district that included a Connor's Steak and Seafood, a Kona Grill, and a King's Bowling and Entertainment. And if you're not familiar with them, they're a bar, restaurant that also has a few bowling lanes, games, karaoke, and live music. It's a really cool operation that I believe started in Boston. You know, one of the bigger redevelopments that we've done in the last couple of years.
CBL has redeveloped 28 of its properties since 2013, spending on average $9.6 million on each location. While it works to redevelop some of its malls, CBL is also selling its weaker performing properties, 20 transactions totaling nearly $800 million. Eastland Mall, which opened in 1967, is staying put. But CBL's Keating says regional malls like Eastland are being converted into what CBL calls suburban town centers.
I think most people define a regional mall as an enclosed shopping center that is primarily retail focused. And that's what our properties were built to be. But for us, it's really redefining what that mall looks like. It's adding components of open air and mixed use. So it's not just a retail focus anymore. It's focused on entertainment and dining and, you know, health and lifestyle options, like I mentioned in some of those earlier examples. So it's really taking what people assume to be a mall, which is strictly retail, and redefining that into a mixed-use indoor-outdoor area where people in the communities where we're located want to gather.
Ron Porth from the Mole Hole totally agrees. He wants to see Eastland become warmer, more inviting. He says add a Starbucks where people can hang out for hours at a time or host community events on the property.
I would like to see an entertainment. They said Northwoods took the Macy's and turned it into kind of a family entertainment area, a bowling alley, and, you know, something that the theater. And I'd like to see a couple good restaurants. I think, you know, you get the mall would get good traffic and positive energy from a couple of good restaurants that people could sit down and eat in and enjoy themselves.
It's difficult for the public not to give up on a mall when they drive by and see Macy's closed and JCPenney's going out of business signs. The Sears, by the way, is staying put for now. And while the malls are dying storyline, maybe playing out in reality in other communities, Keating says that's not happening in Bloomington.
That is definitely a theme that we see in media coverage, that headlines tend to point to malls are dying, it's a retail apocalypse. And I think, you know, Credit Suisse released a report that 20 to 25 malls will close in the next 5 years or something like that. And that's just not at all based in reality. Like I said earlier, our malls are evolving. They're changing into suburban town centers. When malls were first built, they had 4 to 5 fashion anchor stores, and now our properties have 1 to 3 fashion anchor stores, and the rest of that space is being redeveloped into retail, entertainment, restaurant, and other uses that really changes the entire dynamic of the property.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Today we're looking at the future of Eastland Mall in the wake of recent closures there. A major redevelopment is planned, triggered by the closure of Macy's in this fall's upcoming closure of JCPenney. ISU marketing professor Gary Hunter teaches retailing and consumer behavior. He's also a former retail manager himself who used to work at Radio Shack. Hunter says regional malls like Eastland face many pressures, e-commerce and closing anchors to name a few. But he says it's not time to bring out the bulldozers.
I guess I tend to agree with the owners. I don't think the mall is dying. I mean, but it is changing, definitely. If you look in at Bloomington, okay, what other choices do we have, really, in terms of shopping? I mean, I don't think shopping is really going anywhere. We could talk about whether online is just going to completely destroy physical shopping, because if that were to happen, yeah, the mall would die. But do we really think that online is going to completely destroy physical shopping? Or shopping at physical stores? I guess it depends somewhat on who you ask, but right now it's like 8% of sales are online. And of course, that's going to vary by category. But so 92 out of 100 sales are still in a physical store. So at least at this point, physical shopping isn't dying. So the mall isn't going to die.
Ron Porth from the Mole Hole says retail is suffering, and they've been floating on negative energy for too long.
The malls have all gotten kind of cookie cutter, you know, and people are bored. People are bored a lot more easier today than they were 20 years ago. The online is such a competitive element that we have to deal with.
While online sales are still relatively small compared with brick and mortar, they're growing much faster. Online sales jumped 15% in the first quarter of 2017 versus a year ago. That's compared with 5% for physical stores.
So from that growth, I mean, retailers know that e-commerce is going to take a bigger share. The question is, how big a share? When will it end? What's the ultimate balance between e-commerce and physical stores?
2 months ago in Las Vegas, CBL updated its investors on its financial performance. In its myths versus reality presentation, CBL tried to undercut the notion that store closing and bankruptcies are always a bad thing. Department store rationalization is healthy, they said, and bankruptcies make way for improvement. Here's CBL spokeswoman Stacy Keating.
Bankruptcies really do make the way for, you know, other local or regional entrepreneurs to grow their business. If you look back at our top 20 retailer list in 1993, the year we went public, only 2 to 3 of those retailers still exist today. So there's been this chaos and turnover in retail as long as retail has been a business. And so when some retailers close up shop, that that is just a natural evolution of the industry, and it makes way for other uses to come up and expand their presence.
CBL says its space is in high demand from regional chains like Dunham Sports and restaurants like the Cheesecake Factory. Gary Hunter from ISU's College of Business says some department stores, like the ones that are now closing, used to have restaurants inside of them. Think of the old Marshall Fields in downtown Chicago. That was all about bringing people in.
The mall could think of itself and as being a big department store in a way, and bringing in more places that provide experiences like that to people, or that they could bring in super centers for that matter, because people are going to buy groceries. A super center being like a Walmart that has a grocery as well as a general merchandise, and people are going to come because they have to buy their groceries on a regular basis, and then hopefully attract them to the other stores too.
That's Gary Hunter from ISU's College of Business. Before that was Stacy Keating from mall owner CBL and mole hole owner Ron Porth. I'm Ryan Denham.
JCPenney is the next store to close at Eastland Mall. A company spokesman says that's scheduled for October 1st. A recent study suggests 15% of traditional shopping malls will disappear in the next decade. GLT's Sound Ideas Culture Maven says when we lose the malls, we may lose something more than just a collection of shops. Laura Kennedy has more.
Macy's is gone. So's The Gap, Radio Shack, The Limited, MC Sports, and soon Penny's will join the exodus from Eastland Mall in Bloomington. But Eastland is hardly unique. Across the country, malls are dying bit by bit, store by store. Or if they're not dying, at least they're not feeling very well. Nearly a quarter of the malls in the U.S. are at high risk of losing an anchor store. As consumers go elsewhere, like online, to shop, stores close and jobs and revenue vanish. It was just a few decades ago that the mall ruled as a place to shop, to eat, to see a movie. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven, says for 50 years, malls have been a mecca for consumer culture and more.
It was a place to drop off your kids for the day. In their heyday, they were considered safe places for kids to roam, so folks would drop off their kids and go do whatever they do. It was also a place for families to do things together. The malls were really, I think, in many ways owned by the teens, particularly teens who couldn't drive yet, so they didn't have true mobility, but they, perhaps a little bit later than my generation, they had a little money in their pockets. And they could meet, they could roam, they could eat, they could buy stuff, they could play in arcades, they could go to the movies. Let's not forget that during the heyday of mall culture, that was also the primary place to go to a movie. So it was a whole entertainment package, and it really was shopping as entertainment.
Well, as a Gen X latchkey kid myself, mm-hmm. I spent many a Saturday dropped off at the mall mm-hmm. and left on my own. Do you think maybe the fact that the Gen X is getting older and, you know, our generation doesn't feel like we could drop our kids at the mall, that might be contributing to the change of what the mall means to us?
Well, that's a good thought. I do think that we live in an era where folks are more cautious about anonymous crowds. And where people are certainly more cautious about leaving their children unsupervised. I don't know so much about teenagers, but we're in a more fearful culture. Though I think fundamentally the shift away from mall culture is about other cultural dynamics. Certainly in the last 10 years, it's the availability of product online. But there's also there's been something else going on. And from the 70s, when it was all about the convenience of a particular location, an interior location. You know, we talk about teenagers, but there's also a lot of old folks who go to the mall to walk, to get exercise. But to have a place where they were comfortable in terms of climate and relative ease of access and all of those kinds of things, to now when people go out for a shopping day, they want a little bit better food. They like outside spots. So you go to newer strip malls, what I would still call strip malls, but they're not really strip malls, shopping areas in the suburbs. And there will be coffee shops that have some outdoor seating. There's convenient parking, but there's sort of an attempt to make it feel like a neighborhood, like you're entering a little neighborhood that you walk around in, but not too far. Parking's got to be convenient.
Mm-hmm.
That have yes, some anchor stores, but also some specialty stores. So I think it's a difference in how people want to shop specifically. Also, there are other options, many more options for where young people, not adult shoppers, but for where young people can and do go for their entertainment. Certainly.
And that's right in the palm of their hand on their phone.
Well, they can sit on their couch, yes, and not go anywhere for entertainment and chat with their friends and Snapchat and whatever else.
We don't have to be physically together to be together now.
That's exactly right. I mean, for me, certainly, when the first mall appeared in my life in, I don't know, probably when I was 13 or so, perhaps a little bit younger, which was a long, long time ago, it was certainly an event to go to the mall. And it was absolutely about hanging out with friends and feeling freedom, not freedom. It was an expansion of our universe, but in a very controlled way.
When malls became popular, people would say, oh, well, this is the new town square. Was it really the town square for us?
No, it wasn't a new community. It was a new amusement park of some sort. That's different.
At the Mall of America, literally.
Literally the Mall of America. And it was all about consumerism. It's always dangerous to invoke a movie that is beloved by many people, but not so much by yourself. But I'm going to mention the Blues Brothers. And in my view, the greatest scene in the Blues Brothers is when they crash through the mall.
Pants and burgers.
Yeah. Lots of space in this mall. Baby clothes.
This place has got everything.
And so the mall was pretty soon after its inception, as much as it was a place for people to go and shop and in some sense gather, it was also reviled as the height of trashy American consumerism.
People looked down their nose at the mall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So some of the sort of new shopping experiences that aren't online are about being classier in some way and really trying to create this feeling of neighborhood and one area being distinct from another in terms of its walking paths and the kinds of flowers that are planted and the style of the buildings and that sort of thing.
Well, speaking of people who are looking down on the mall, maybe George Romero felt that way in Dawn of the Dead, which, you know, he had zombies taking over a mall. And I think it's interesting because the zombies apparently were congregating at the mall because that's what they were used to doing.
Most of the gates are down. I don't think they can get into the stores.
I haven't seen any of them up on the second floor.
Big department stores usually use both floors.
Then we can get in up top.
What are they doing? Why did they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
But was Romero making a comment on malls in our society in that film?
Oh, absolutely. But like I say, malls are, from their inception, really, they were equally delighted in for their various conveniences and the pleasures of consumerism. And that's where we'd go see movies. I mean, I can't minimize that enough. That was a huge part of the draw to malls and of shifting viewing patterns of people interested in cinema in this culture. But at the same time, they were so blatantly pans to consumerism and really the trashiest parts of American culture, the most blatantly greedy and money-oriented and thing-oriented and acquisition-oriented sort of structures that we inhabited that filmmakers and comedians and others attack them in many different forms.
What are we losing when we start to lose traditional malls and they start shutting down in communities?
I don't think you can separate this from the loss in general of the brick-and-mortar store, right? So I think what we're losing in malls specifically is, more importantly, about what we're losing in terms of local income, local jobs, and taxes and all of those kinds of things. I think that's the real problem with losing the mall, and also because those very large businesses that have been standards of not just consumerism, but the access to products for decades and decades and decades, such as Sears and others, in losing that storefront income, they're also going under. Now, with that, in terms of malls specifically, let's forget teenagers for a moment. Let's go back to old people. So you are an older person and you need to get some exercise, but it's particularly dangerous for you to be out in the cold, the wet, icy streets. Where do you go for that exercise? If you can't afford a health club, Where do you go for that exercise? Where do you go to be able to walk around with your friends and have a comfortable place to sit and some place to eat and yet also get the mobility that every study on the planet shows us that we need, even and especially as we get older, for both our physical and mental health? So I worry about the destruction of these large interior spaces, whether they are commercial and consumerist or not. The destruction of those kinds of spaces, I think, actually will have health effects that we haven't really anticipated, particularly for those people who are not sufficiently affluent to join health clubs and who don't have access to senior centers that have robust facilities and that sort of thing.
With so many malls dying off, there's almost a sort of a genre or a subgenre of photography that seems to be coming to the fore, dead malls. People going, mm-hmm. photographers going into malls and photographing what was once a thriving, vibrant part of the community. And then you just see these empty spaces. And I'm almost like, it's like dead mall porn, looking at these photographs. And you can imagine how they once were. And you see what they've become. And it's like looking at the remnants of an ancient civilization gone to
yes.
ruin.
Yes. Well, it used to be photographs of small town America. And before that, it was the West. And before that, it was
dead downtowns.
I don't know, Greece
we had dead,
or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're right. But what is so interesting in that in particular is how quickly this has happened. I mean, it feels like the move toward destruction and decay and things being remnants of the past is happening in a much more accelerated fashion, right? We're not talking about photographs of outposts in the Old West that were constructed in the early 1800s that then were abandoned by the 1880s or something. We're talking about within a span of 40 or 50 years, something that's gone from non-existence to abandonment and decay. That's really pretty astounding.
Is it a little disturbing to you?
It's very disturbing to me, yeah.
What does it say about us?
Well, for one thing, I think it says something about the quality of construction, right?
Yes.
Seriously, I think it's something about the quality of construction that has changed. There is something about that, but I think it's more about the quickness with which our culture abandons things. And sadly, I think that is also reflected in the way we abandon each other. So there's such an incredible instability about what we hold on to and what we value. Some would say this makes the future exciting. I think it makes it kind of scary. It feels grotesque to be sit here mourning the loss of this incredible homage to retail, mm-hmm. to the gluttony of American consumerism. That seems just a little bit ridiculous. But it seems to me as a culture, we have this incredible desire to not get out of our chair, right? So on the one hand, there's been this move toward more and more sedentary life, right? The remote control. I mean, God forbid you would get up and cross the room
to change the channel.
Oh. But now, God forbid you would get up and cross the room every 2 hours to change the movie. I can tell you myself, I have a two-floor house and I have 2,500 CDs. But if I'm hankering to listen to one song, I'm just as likely to buy it for 99 cents. I know, I haven't entered the Spotify world.
Instead of going upstairs,
finding the CD, bringing it down, putting it. That's crazy. But I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in that sort of thing. On the other hand, everything else in our culture is about mobility. We want to be able to take our whole computing life with us and hold it in the palm of our hand. Certainly nothing is diminished about car culture. One of the hottest topics, as it should be, in communities is about how to get people from one place to another. When we talk about getting social services to people who need them, often the biggest chunk of it is not getting a dentist to volunteer his or her time. It's how do you get the people from the poorer part of town to the dentist? How do you get them away from their jobs to go to the dentist? That sort of thing. So we live in a town that has hundreds of parking spaces, and yet the number one complaint you hear about our town is there's no parking. Well, there's plenty of it. It's just not 10 feet in front of the store.
Right.
It's a block away, a block away. So this tension we have in which we really want things to be close and immediate, and yet we want total mobility. And to me, it sort of seems like the mall answers that tension, and yet we want it gone, or we have moved away from that.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Illinois State University's Milner Library and GLT's culture maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In case you were wondering, the mall that the Blues Brothers crashed through in the 1980 film recently met the wrecking ball for real. The Dixie Square Mall in Harvey, Illinois, was officially demolished in 2012. You're listening to Sound Ideas and the Valley of the Malls, the Fountains of Wayne on GLT. Valley of the Malls, the Fountains of Wayne on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, catch up with the Robert Brown Band. Their new album is called Phantom Power. John Norton has the interview. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Your dog's natural means of communication can sometimes be problematic. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of Animal House.
All dogs come pre-equipped with a bark, be it a high-pitched yip, a soulful bray, or a mellow woof. It's how the dog communicates. Sometimes, though, it can get out of hand. Dog trainer Bob Ryder from Positive Transformation says dogs bark for lots of reasons. And from the dog's point of view, all of them are legitimate.
Even if it looks to you or me like there's no reason for him to be or her to be standing there barking his or her fool head off, as some people like to say. But to the dog, it seems to be satisfying a need, whether that's calling for company because I'm all by myself, or I'm bored and I wish there was something to do, or mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, somebody's coming into my yard, go away, or lots of other reasons. So it's important to keep in mind that to the dog, it seems to make sense and it's fulfilling a need.
So when we have a dog who is barking excessively and we are concerned about that dog, we want to find out what's going on, mm-hmm. What's causing that barking. Could there be a health concern going on there? Could the dog have a hearing issue or a vision issue, and the barking might be coming from the fact that he can't really see who's coming? That might be friend or foe, so I'm going to bark. Or if you startle him because he didn't hear you coming up and he barked, do we need to go to the vet and rule out health concerns with regards to barking?
Sure. Health issues can definitely be a source of motivation for a dog to bark. It's probably worth saying for a moment that excessive is a relative term.
Yes.
Excessive is in the eye, or I guess in this case,
ear.
The ear of the beholder. Think of friends or family members you have who probably have different patterns of how much they talk when they're in company with other people. Or I've even seen people who are by themselves driving along in the car. Clearly they're talking. They don't seem to have an earpiece in. It looks like maybe they're singing, you know, the lyrics to a song. Just passing time, you know, barking can be just a way of amusing yourself. But if it seems to be excessive, it seems like the dog just can't stop, or it's changed suddenly, you know, in recent history. My dog, you know, never used to bark very much, and all of a sudden the last couple of weeks, he's barking all the time. Yeah, I would look for medical causes. A veterinary checkup would be a great place to start.
What are some patterns to notice with regards to barking?
Well, I tell clients of mine to pay attention to, does it happen at certain times of day? Does it happen for long periods incessantly, or does it tend to come and go, depending on if there's a passerby outside, perhaps? Does it happen when the dog is in the car, or does it happen in the house, in the car, but never in the backyard? Some detective work can take you a long way toward figuring out what's causing, what's motivating your dog to bark and how to make some interventions to make it easier for him not to.
So we need to keep our eye out for some behavioral prompts, perhaps?
Sure. Like any behavior, barking is subject to the laws of both classical conditioning and operant conditioning. Operant conditioning, though, you know, if the barking accomplishes something, if it, you know, makes something good happen, or if it makes something unpleasant go away or stop, the barking is going to increase. There's either positive reinforcement where it makes something good happen, or negative reinforcement where it makes something unpleasant go away. And from the dog's point of view, you know, sounding the alarm or calling for company, it worked. So I'm going to do that again. When I bark, it makes mom look at me and talk to me. She noticed me. She looked. She talked. So, you know, if I bark, that makes mom come and play with me or come.
So we've conditioned the dog.
So, yeah, barking can be increased or decreased based on the consequences. And it also can be a source of stress relief.
I've got a video that I want to show you, Bob.
Okay.
I took this last weekend. I got home on a Friday evening, and there was a dog across the street who was staked out. And it was a nice evening. And the dog was barking on and on and on. Mm-hmm. The dog was by itself. I didn't see any other critters around. I wasn't too concerned because his tail was wagging. So here's the video. Take a look at that.
Okay.
And tell me what you think is going on.
Happy to. So this dog is, like you said, he's staked out in his yard. The video, at least, doesn't show any passersby or other dogs or critters nearby. A car passed, but he didn't seem to be paying attention to that. This looks to me like a dog who is just bored and not sure what to do with himself. Even before I started watching the video, when you told me he's staked out, that's always kind of a yellow or sometimes a red flag for me, because the dog is left to his own devices with no really meaningful activity unless, you know, he chose to dig, which comes naturally to dogs, and probably the owner wouldn't like that very well. So this just looks to me like a dog who's, he seems to be waiting for a response. He's barking and just hoping for an answer, maybe. He doesn't seem to be threatened or trying to drive away an intruder or warn somebody away from him.
His tail is wagging, so that's why I didn't get too concerned, because I thought, well, he must have a kind of a pleasant mood going on there if his tail is wagging.
Well, there's a lot to know about tail wagging. It can mean that a dog is relaxed and playful, but not always. There's plenty of tail wagging that goes along with aggressive behavior or defensive behavior.
So I looked at that as a clue to, okay, the dog's okay, I don't need to be concerned.
But yeah, it's much more helpful to look at the whole picture than just the tail wagging. In the context, or, you know, on the subject of barking, that dog just looked like, you know, he didn't know what else to do with himself, and he's kind of barking because what else is there to do? Hey, is anybody going to come and play with me, or bring me in and feed me dinner, or take me for a walk? And I think it's too bad when we leave dogs out by themselves in that situation to amuse themselves with no guidance or company. It's much better for dogs to be supervised and monitored. I would much rather see a dog in a fenced-in yard and, you know, given some meaningful activities to do.
So if we have a dog that is barking to what we perceive as excess, and maybe the dog is barking out of stress or what have you, and we want the dog to feel more comfortable, what are some of the solutions? I would think that if you've got a dog at the window, looking at the window and barking at the traffic going by, I would get some curtains or some plantation shutters so the dog couldn't see out the window. Is that a solution?
Yeah, sure. That's the great observation. There's always several parts to getting the behavior that you want from your dog or your husband or your kids or your parents. And part of it is always setting up the environment so that the behavior we want is the easiest, most convenient behavior, and the behavior we don't want or don't like is harder to come by. It's less necessary. So for a dog, you know, barking at passersby from the window, a well-placed baby gate or a closed door or closed blinds or shutters, depending on how determined the dog is to get to be able to see what's going on, just preventing them from seeing the activity can be one part of the solution.
And with regards to positive reinforcement, should we not reinforce barking by giving the dog attention when the dog is barking?
Well, correct. And there's a lot to be gained by understanding the difference between, I'm going to talk about punishment for a minute. Punishment really isn't your best solution to a problem. It can work temporarily if you do it right.
So yelling at the dog may not be the long-term solution.
Yeah, that might actually end up encouraging the behavior because the dog may think, well, now you're barking too, or now you're making things even more stressful, and everybody just shut up. But there's a concept my teacher and friend, the eminent trainer Pat Miller, talks about: the value of gently interrupting a behavior so that it doesn't keep up its own momentum. It doesn't have much of a chance, or any chance, hopefully, to be reinforced. Just gently interrupting the dog and redirecting them to another more acceptable activity. My dog, a yellow lab, Daisy, will bark at kids, you know, riding their bikes or skateboards in front of our house just for a moment or two. And as soon as she gets started, I'll say, Daisy, come here. I'll just recall her to me. She knows she gets a treat for that. So that's kind of an automatic decision for her. And then I'll get out a squeaky toy or Kong with some peanut butter or something else for her to do. I might play tug if I have a few minutes, just to keep her busy until the activity outside is done. And then, you know, I've just kept her from practicing that behavior. Anything that your dog is doing, including barking, is something that's going to come more easily and more automatically next time the situation arises. So there's a ton to be gained in that old adage, an ounce of prevention or like we just said, interrupting and redirecting. It doesn't have to be harsh or angry or mean. It can just be kind of helpfully, you know, getting your dog involved in something that's more appropriate.
How do you talk people out of going to an extreme reaction? That is, shock collars or even worse, surgery to alter the dog's vocal cords so that dog can't bark anymore?
Well, I try to do it as gently and patiently as I can because it seems like an obvious kind of automatic solution to people. Education is always, I think, the most useful thing. When people understand that the dog is barking for a reason, the dog has some unmet need, and it's not just barking to annoy other members of the household, that it's trying to meet some need of its own. That informs us, well, let's figure out what that need is. If we were to just shock the dog, or there are collars that spray citronella when the dog barks, I also don't like those. Certainly something as radical as surgery to remove the vocal cords. All of that may, not automatically, but may help reduce the barking somewhat, but it hasn't helped the dog at all. The dog still has all the same problems or all the same unmet needs as they did before. And now we're just letting the dog experience that in silence, which is certainly not humane and not the reason most people get a dog. We want to be the dog's friend and caretaker and make sure they have good quality of life. The best way to reduce an unwanted behavior is to replace it with a behavior that you like better, hopefully an incompatible behavior. So if I don't want the barking, the question I want to ask myself is, what do I want my dog to be doing right now? What can I reward? What behavior can I reinforce so that the dog is too busy doing something else to be barking? I would be perfectly happy if my dog were over in the corner working on a chew toy, or, you know, in an exercise pen that keeps her from being able to get to the windows, taking a nap because she had lots of exercise and, you know, we did some training and she learned some new tricks. So plentiful exercise and mental stimulation can reduce the need to bark or reduce the amount of energy a dog has to bark. If the dog is a real vocal breed, like old beagles can be really vocal, they have that baying kind of roar sound.
Mm-hmm.
I might decide that there's a few times a week that I'll take my dog to a situation where, let's say we're going to go out in the backyard and hunt for little treats, or I'm going to get a toy and put it on a rope and let the dog chase it around in the yard, and they can bay and bark and sing all they want to there. That might express some of the need to bark, and then they can come inside and, all right, I've said all I had to say now.
That's trainer Bob Ryder from Positive Transformations. When it comes to your dog barking, no matter what, stay calm. So your dog has the chance to mirror your energy. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can send your pet-related questions to one of our Animal House team of experts at our website, WGLT.org.
time can feel slow.
An hour takes forever when you're five.
Time can feel fast.
There's a lot you can capture with just a second.
Time is always changing.
You're seeing the past, you're in the present, you're thinking about the future. It's all there. It focuses us on life.
I'm Guy Raz, shifting time on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Robert Brown Band, based in Bloomington, has just released their sophomore album. Band leader Robert Brown says the trio, including Travis Wheat and Micah Hadaway, has evolved from a bluesy rock to a heavier rock sound. Brown joined John Norton recently in the GLT studios to talk about the album titled Phantom Power. It's not
Hills is from the brand new album. Some of the lyrics include, is this real? What I'm feeling, is this real? Or am I dreaming my life away? It's on your just released Phantom Power album. Love is a Ghost is the name of the previous album. So what I'm hearing here is a lot of imagination, a lot of hauntingness, things like that. And in Pills, it even implies that things don't really exist. What's going on here?
John, you're really digging in.
I'm digging in, man. So, I mean, does it describe something about your life?
Yeah, definitely. It describes the daily, why are we doing this? Why are some people amazing and some people...
Why are we doing this? I mean, life?
Just life. Just what do we do every day? Why do we go to work? Why do we go to church? Why do we love our kids? Why do we have certain friends we have? Why do some people treat you awesome and some people are all about themselves? The pill part of it, I just know so many, especially women or other friends that, they take anxiety medicine or they take painkillers or they take whatever, and it's like oh my god, I gotta swallow a pill just to deal with reality. Down the line some point, if you sedate yourself to a point where you're just like, what is real, what is not, why do I feel like I need this to be able to do this, or that's pretty much the gist of why the song is called Pills and how that kind of came out.
The song is Pills, the Robert Brown Band, and Robert Brown himself joins us in studio here on GLT. You're a business guy as well.
Very true.
I mean, music, I guess, is a business as well, but you're also a business guy away from music.
Uh-huh.
How does the music help you deal with that, or how does the business help you deal with music?
The music is like therapy for me, honestly, and that's where, we're promoting this record and releasing this record, but, we're not even playing shows right now. My band, Travis Wheat and Micah Hadaway, are out doing their thing right now with Old Smoke and Peggy Hadaway, great singer. They do like party tunes and some original stuff too. And we kind of had this hiatus we've kind of came to lately just because they want to play shows, because that's the part of why they play music that they love. Not that I don't as well, but they have to have that tour and where are we going, where are we playing, what's next. Where I kind of selfishly sometimes just like to indulge in recording, writing songs, and I have a fix that I get there. That's where I'm at with why I play music. It's definitely, I love playing live. And
let's go to another song on the album. It's called Phantom Power, Long Time Coming. And let me play just a little snippet of the song before I ask you about it.
It's been a long time coming. It's so good to be here with my friends.
The titles of the albums that I mentioned earlier, they sort of conjure up a drifting person. The song here, Long Time Coming, lyrics like, it's good to be here, has a different vibe to it. When you sing about that in this song, when you write about it's good to be here, where is here?
Here is there in that moment. We opened that, we've opened with that song so many times. And it's actually, it's good to be here with my friends.
Okay.
Is the next line in that song. So, I mean, yeah, it's that moment that show, that promotion, all that work goes into putting on a rock show. And that is here.
It's been a long, long time coming.
Robert Brown of the Robert Brown Band joins us in studio. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. You mentioned to me off the air that you've evolved sort of from more of a blues-based rock band to more of a heavier rock band. Is there anything to read into that?
What do you mean by read into?
I mean, you're changing your sound or just evolving a little bit? Or
no, not at all. I mean, I've always changed my sound, and you know, some of the players I play with probably wish I would find a genre and stick with it, but no names on that. But
you know, Dylan went back and forth on a lot of things,
right? Yeah.
You know?
Well, one of my all-time mentors is Dave Grohl. I mean, if you heard his newest song out right
sure,
now, it's
yeah.
heavy as hell. You know, yeah. It's like, I love that. You. There's no rules. When I have a recording engineering degree, and you know, I've been doing this since I was a kid. I grew up playing drums in my dad's worship band in the First Assembly of God Church.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So is that sort of where you got your start, in a way?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we talked to a lot of the black artists. You know, a lot of those women, they come from the choirs. They come from, you know, the church stuff. Uh-huh. Don't talk to a lot of white people that come from the church, that go to the music, right? I mean, that's their base. I'm Catholic, so, you know, we have this little choir that sits up front, you know,
right.
St. Mary's, and they're really good. Holy Trinity's really good, you know, but you don't think of that as the same kind of gospel choir as in the black church.
And we definitely wasn't that. We had a choir, but it was not a black gospel choir type thing. I mean, that is something I would love to put on a record too.
Yeah.
Capture that power. This record, especially, is 2 years in the making. And it's like, oh my God, we need to go into a studio this next, you know, I've got a RBB3 that...
You need someone cracking the whip on you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
making tough choices.
Make that decision. Tough shit, you got to stick, or tough crap, you got to stick with it and get this record done and move on. And creatively, I think it'll be better.
You were telling me that, not necessarily your favorite song, but maybe the song you have a certain pride in, and it's called Make You Proud, that you put on the album. Matter of fact, you got two versions. You got a live version and a studio version on here.
I'm gonna live to make you proud. Make you proud of me.
Make you proud. What makes you so proud about Make You Proud?
It's special because, I mean, it's a song about loss. You know, I lost my best friend in 2005. He was killed in the Marines in Iraq. Whether it's, you know, in my particular instance it was that, but you know, I think it's a song that a lot of people could relate to if you put yourself in the scenario where they're watching, you know. And you know, my love for that song is just because I almost get choked up every time I think about it. A song that draws that emotion. You kind of change your life in the way that they're watching you, and you don't want to make them. You want to make them proud. You don't want them to be like, oh my God, you're not living right. You're not doing things good. You know, that's that song.
That's beautiful.
Thanks,
Robert Brown of the Robert Brown Band. Thanks for coming in. Congratulations on Phantom Power. This is a fantastic release. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bloomington's Robert Brown speaking with GLT's John Norton about the new album from the Robert Brown Band. Phantom Power is now available at the usual outlets, including iTunes and CD Baby. The song you're hearing is Proud of You from the new album. Find all of our music reporting with our GLT Music podcast. Find it at WGLT.org, NPR One, or your favorite podcast app.
Until we meet again. I won't.
Proud of You, the Robert Brown Band on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find all of the individual stories and interviews today. Thanks to John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and Ryan Denham. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. Let us know what you think of this show by emailing news@WGLT.org or share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is GLT and WGLT.org, 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's public media.